Welcome to Dog Talk and Kitties Too. I'm Tracy Hotchner. I love cats and dogs and the people who care about them. I'm proud to be on the NPR station Peconic Public Broadcasting, where this show originated and has continued for 13 years and over 600 consecutive shows. To download any episode, go to RadioPetLady.com, where you can also find information about my New York dog and cat film festivals, which travel the country year-round, benefiting a local animal welfare group at every location. Dog Talk is a production of Pet Media, Inc., which is solely responsible for its content. This show is brought to you with the generous support of Woruva, a family-owned pet food company that makes a wide assortment of canned foods for cats and dogs in a human food facility, with ingredients that are good enough for people to eat. Woruva is also a sponsor of the New York Dog and New York Cat Film Festivals and makes donations of their foods to beneficiary shelters. This show is also made possible by Dr. Elsie's Precious Cat. Privately owned by Dr. Elsie, a feline-only veterinarian in Colorado, who has created specialized litters to satisfy the needs of every kind of cat. Precious Cat donates thousands of pounds of litter to shelters nationwide and is also the founding sponsor of the New York Cat Film Festival. My guests today are Kim Dower with her new book of poems, Sunbathing on Tyrone Power's Grave, Nathan Hall, who's doing olfactory research and finds that pugs have better noses than German shepherds, and Susan Ward will be here from Perfect Pals. She has the Kitten and Cat Connection foster program at a prison with prisoners raising kitties. I am back with Kim Dower. She read us a poem, I don't know, it seems like 2 years ago, called Naming the Puppy, one of the most delicious poems ever. Now she has her third book of poetry being published, which those of you that follow literature know that that's lightning striking not once, not twice, but three times from Red Hen Press, which is a wonderful, eclectic publisher, and it's called Sunbathing on Tyrone Power's Grave. What could be a better title for a book than that? It is chock full of poems about dogs, which is why Kim is here. Kim, congratulations on yet another just extraordinary collection of delicious, accessible, funny, interesting, poignant poems that make you feel smart and not stupid. That's my personal sort of yardstick for good poetry. I'm like, I get it. I love it. It feels good, as opposed to, huh?
Yeah, well, thank you. Well, can I just say, I mean, it was the most beautiful introduction, but it's my fourth, actually.
Oh, my God.
My fourth book, you see. It's just, who can even believe that? But, yeah, and I'm writing more and more about animals, particularly dogs. So I find that interesting. I think that dogs and animals have become much more, they're sort of inside me. I dream of them. I see them everywhere where I didn't used to. It's an interesting development for me.
Isn't that curious? I just, in order to place you in the stratosphere of writers and poets, I'm just going to do a little bragging about you from the back cover of the book, because it's so rare for a poet to have any acknowledgement from the outside world. I mean, to be published is amazing, to be reviewed is extraordinary, to get awards, to be nominated for awards. And I think that before people listen to these poems, and I hope buy the book, Sunbathing on Tyrone Power's Grave, because even those of you that might spend 2 or 3 minutes a week thinking not about dogs and cats might be interested in some of her other topics. But Kim also teaches poetry at Antioch University. She was the City Poet Laureate of West Hollywood for 2 years, nominated for 2 Pushcart Prizes, featured in a lot of really impressive publications that have anthologies and so forth. And O Magazine gave you For a Slice of Moon, a wonderful accolade. So did the LA Times. You've really been recognized a lot. The Poetry Foundation's Contemporary Bestsellers List. A lot of really cool things. So I just want, when people listen, to understand that I didn't find you like under a rock. I just got lucky that I bumped into your rock and you're sitting on top of it sunbathing, so to speak.
Oh, I just love the whole rock image.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you, Tracy. And thank you for having me on your show to read these poems, because I know that's not normally what you do. So I appreciate it so much.
I do once in a while. I had you. I have Billy Collins. I mean, there's a few poets. I've read Mary Oliver's poems not long ago because they're so yummy. But it's rare to have a poet read her own poems, and I'm very excited to have you start. So why don't you start with Naming the Puppy, which you read a number of years for us, but here it is, and it hadn't been published anywhere yet. Here it is between the covers of this beautiful collection, and we'll just start with that and move right along to other dog ones.
Thank you. I will. And this poem and a few of the others that I'll be reading today were inspired by a little puppy. Well, I won't give her name away, but my son and his girlfriend got a puppy, and that dog has pretty much changed my life in a lot of ways.
Wow.
Yeah, it's interesting. It is. So this is the first poem in honor of her, and it's called Naming the Puppy. They're young and in love, so they think of human names. Zoe, Ruby, Judy, like the name of a girl you'd sit next to in math. They move on to dog baby names, Lammy, Girl, Puppy. They like Puppy, so for an hour, that's what she's called. Come here, Puppy, they sing, her paws, pink, tender, slide across the room. Puppy is a sweet name, I tell them. But soon your puppy won't be a puppy. And when she hurtles through the park, her teeth locked onto a sloppy stick, a pit bull chasing her down, how will it sound when you call, puppy, puppy? Your voice is airy as frisbees floating across the grass. I watch the puppy lick my son's lips, nibble his girlfriend's nose, devour their faces as if they were made of sugar, devoted furball, all ears and eyes, eyes that have been on this earth before. By dinner time, her name is Gwen, a star's name, a nurse's, or what you'd call the middle child of a noisy family. I watch Gwen pour herself into their arms. There is no name for the way she loves them, no name for a sun that shines only for you.
Such a wonderful poem. These little asides, these little recognitions of the little things in life, names of a girl that would sit next to you in math. How has Gwen changed your life?
She has these eyes, Tracy, that are, they're human. I mean, they're, when she looks at me, I feel like she really understands me.
Nice.
And she has such compassion. She's a real girl's dog. So she's, if there's any girl, any woman in the room, she wants to be with them. Even though, you know, she's my son's dog and she'll protect him and she adores him, she loves the girls. So if, you know, if I have a friend over or whatever it is, it's just, she's almost like, please, would you just let me into this little soiree? I want to be. And I think she's changed my life by, when she's around, I calm down and I want to just like sort of lie on the couch with her and read to her. She's become human to me. I don't know. It's weird.
How great. Yeah. I mean, it's not weird to the people listening.
Yes, I know.
You know, I mean, but I refer to my girls as people.
Right.
Somebody over there needs to lick that plate. You know, it's like they just happen to do a lot of things with their tongues as if our faces were made of sugar, which is such a great metaphor, analogy, whichever that is. As a teacher, I'm sure you would correct me immediately. I always get confused between the two.
Well,
all right. So here's another poem about Gwen. Gwen is scared of the wooden fish.
Yes. So Gwen spends a lot of time in our house, and as you know, and your listeners, they investigate everything, and a lot of things must be confusing. Gwen is scared of the wooden fish. She's a puppy, gets confused by objects that stare but do not move. The wooden fish, painted yellow, blue, green, with a pink fish painted in the middle, leaning against the orange dining room wall, for example, We bought it long ago, one summer, roadside, Mexican border. A man with his own dog made them, sold them to tourists heading home. We've always loved the fish, the way it's carved, the way it continues to balance on the hardwood floor. Gwen pushes it with her nose, licks it like it's her baby, looks at me as if to say, why doesn't it have a tongue? Why isn't this thing kissing me back? She jumps away each time it doesn't move. We reassure her it's okay, this wooden fish that fills us with memories.
Lovely. Absolutely lovely. I love about a great poem that it is and isn't what it seems to be about. I mean, there's something really wonderful about the ability of a poem to do that. You're having fun as the listener or the reader, and suddenly something strikes you as, oh, yeah. And then there's that.
Yeah, right. That's what we call the turn in the poem.
I see. You see, as a teacher, I'm sure there are names for everything. The turn in the poem. Those are always the ones that get me.
The turn, I know. You want it to have that turn.
I see. And that's really cool to know.
They say, Tracy, like a good poem is about one thing, but it's also about the other thing.
Oh, I like that. That's so great.
So there you go.
That's so great. That's just so elliptical and odd, and it makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's have you read Gwen is Scared of the Lemon.
Gwen is Scared of the Lemon. This is definitely about one thing, and it's about the other thing.
Yeah.
Gwen is Scared of the Lemon. I can't find a ball, so I grab a lemon from the tree. It's round. It rolls. It even smells like pee. Bright yellow, glows in the sun as it shimmies through grass and dirt in her paradise backyard. She catches it in her teeth, oozes out bitter, no treat, and now she's confused. What's this thing that squirts, a world of doubt, for a mouth that's never tasted what we humans squeeze on fish? She backs off, growls, barks in frustration, smacks it with her paw, licks it, pushes it with her nose, bites its face off, won't let me take it away. It's her lemon now, and there's nothing left of it to throw. I'm ashamed I tried to fool her this way. I was trying to please her in the moment by pretending one thing was as good as something else. We all do it, don't we? Tofu is not meat. Those are not the kisses that make your heart beat.
Fantastic. It's so great. It also, the thing, the other thing is the poignant part, of course, but the thing reminded me of my dog Roma, who, when I lived at one point in LA and was renting a little house up in Bel Air, it had some lemon trees and a pool bigger than the house, old fashioned. And she loved to swim, being a golden retriever, and loved to fetch. And the first time I discovered that lemons float in the pool, nothing was better than going out for a fetch and swimming all over the pool with the lemon in your mouth, and that wonderful lemon oil would kind of shimmer on the surface of the water, and everything would become fragrant. And she learned as a youngster not to bite down.
Oh,
we also had a kumquat tree when she was a puppy, and those are so sour if you bite in. So sweet, and strangely enough, on the peel, and so sour on the inside. Anyway, it's wonderful to see dogs and lemons. It's a whole nother kind of ball. It's a whole nother ball game, let's put it that way.
It is a whole other ball game, and it's a big mess in the backyard.
It is, in fact. All right, let's have you read the one called Dogs and Poetry.
Dogs and Poetry. So I mentioned that I've been dreaming a lot about animals, and so this poem came directly from a dream, and it was so real, Tracy. I woke up in the middle of the night, and I just wrote this out.
Wow.
Dogs and Poetry. Last night, I dreamed dogs were giving a reading in my living room. Long-haired, handsome, golden and chocolate teacup poodles, a mix or two, panting, stacked on a loft, pouncing one at a time onto center stage couch, poems wet in their teeth. Collies on edge, pugs in love, shepherds fierce with loyalty, labs with their hot heads in my lap. I was sitting with them, coaching, petting, biscuits by my side, rewards for their poems, mostly about love, which astonished the audience. A miracle, so fresh, original. They barked in iambic pentameter, singing the blues. These dogs were so damn cool, we all wanted to nibble their pink bellies, suck life into our tired souls.
That is just the singly most delicious poem ever. I mean, poems wet in their teeth. I mean, what could be better than that? And nibbling their pink, it's just everything's turned on its ear, isn't it, in your dream?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was so real. And I think, wow, you know, there's a lot of anxiety dreams before you give a poetry reading and stuff.
Right.
This is the opposite of an anxiety dream. It was just the purest dream. It was so real to me.
Well, you made it very real to us as well, although hilarious. It's almost like a painting. I can just see the painting. Very fun. All right, the next one is mourning.
Yes, mourning.
As in M-O-U-R-N, mourning.
Yeah, so I, you know, Gwen is like, you know, my grandchild dog.
Right.
But we always had dogs and a lot of dogs my whole life. We had two dogs at a certain time, a certain period, and they died within a couple of years of one another. But you know what it's like, and everyone listening knows what it's like to have a dog. When you come home, that dog is part of the door. I mean, you open the
right
door and there's your dog. So it takes a long time to not have that memory.
That's right.
Never, really. You never not
yes
have it.
Yes.
So this poem is called Mourning. Every time a piece of food drops on the floor, I brace for my cockapoo to race, screeching nails slide across wooden floors, rush to slurp up the fallen crumbs. But there is no dog. Not anymore. My feet under the kitchen table no longer rest on his back, toes buried inside his fur, now have no place to go. He's not here to jump up when I sneeze or to growl at invisible intruders. I thought I was used to his being gone, but every time I walk through my front door, I'm still careful not to step on him, my phantom greeter. And I bend down to pet a memory.
It's really great. And I'd like to actually end on that note of that one, because so many of us have the lingering grief and sadness over the absence and loss of a dog. And this very visceral reminder of the little small ways all day, every day, that our dogs weave into our smallest actions. And what a hole it leaves when they're gone. How we really expect to have that cockapoo slide across the floor and find that one little eensy teensy crumb and act like it was a bonanza. Wowie. There's something about that excitement over absolutely a microscopic little piece of, you know,
yes,
I don't know, carrot, that it just keeps us so grounded, and then we lose that grounding.
Well, I think you just hit something, which is why dogs, again, have changed my life. It's their exuberance. And poetry is about seeing something in nothing, basically.
Nice.
And dogs see that every minute. They get so excited by things. They're like, why are they excited by that stick? And yet, that stick is the world to them at that moment. And they show us that. So I think that that's so true, what you just said.
Well, you said it beautifully in all of these poems. We've come to the end of our time, but it was a real treat. Those of you that want to read these and more, so many wonderful poems, Sunbathing on Tyrone Power's Grave, I'll put a link to it in with the podcast of the show. Kim Dower, keep writing, keep teaching, keep looking for the thing and the other thing and showing it to us. It was really a treat.
Thank you so much, Tracy. Thank you.
It was a pleasure. I'll be right back after this quick word. This show is supported by Comfort Zone plug-in diffusers, which release pheromones into the air, which have been scientifically proven to help lower stress in cats and reduce unwanted behavior. Satisfaction is guaranteed or money back. Comfort Zone is also the grand presenting sponsor of the New York Cat Film Festival, providing free pheromone diffusers to audience members and for new adopters at the local shelters. This show is also brought to you by Elevet Sciences, CBD oil products with the proven anti-inflammatory and pain-relieving properties of the hemp plant. A clinical trial at Cornell University Veterinary College proved that CBD oil is effective in managing arthritis and chronic pain in older dogs. More information about whether your own aging dog can benefit is at ElevetSciences.com. I'm here with Nathan Hall, who specializes in olfactory research on dogs. That is, how do they smell? Who smells better than somebody else? He was part of the Arizona State University Canine Science Collaboratory, and now he's an assistant professor at Texas Tech University in the Canine Olfaction Lab. Wow, Nathan, you are just like the nose guy. You have been at this for a while.
Well, hello. Thank you.
It's nice to meet you and exciting to find somebody working so creatively in trying to find out. Well, we know from, you know, Alexander Horowitz's book or the book from the gentleman in Sweden about the secrets of the snout. We understand, we lay people, yeah, dogs have 9 bazillion receptors and we have 3, but we don't really know why, how, or when they work. And that is that what you're trying to do, is drill it down to what do they smell, how do they smell, how do we get them to smell better, and which dogs do better than others?
Right, exactly. So that's pretty much everything that we're looking at and more. But you know, that's a great question. So a lot of times we like to compare things like numbers, you know.
Right.
Dog has this many billion, and
yes,
we have this many billion.
Yeah.
But then no one ever thinks, well, what does that mean, right?
Right.
That seems to be a pretty logical follow-up question. But it's a lot easier to compare numbers or looks, right? Like the dog's nose is longer than our nose. And it's like, okay, so what does that mean?
Right.
So that's a lot of the things that we're trying to answer is, what does that mean, right? You know, the pug's nose is really short, so they must be bad, and German Shepherds must be good because they have long noses. But a lot of times, no one's ever actually paid the time to train the dogs and see and ask them from their perspective, well, what do you smell, and how good are you at it? And a lot of times, you get some curious results that you may not have expected. Because a lot of times we just don't ask the dogs what do they smell.
Or as you say, we make assumptions. So people make assumptions,
yes.
Gee, a brachycephalic dog, whether it's an English bulldog or a French bulldog or a pug, there's not much nose there, so they don't have, we think we know something, of this long canal full of receptors, full of information gatherers. Tell a little bit about this really cool study that you set up when you were at Arizona State, and actually comparing pugs, which are, people would think, well, that's illogical. That's not a working dog. That's a lap dog. And the German Shepherd dog that everyone had presumed would be like the guy to rock it.
Yeah, well, exactly. So, well, when we got started, you know, different breeds have been used, you know, historically for a long period of time for different kinds of jobs. And pretty traditionally, when it comes to your detection dogs, you know, the German Shepherd, the Malinois, well, recently now the Labrador.
Right.
These dogs have been quite commonly used for detection work, but you know, a lot of other dogs have not. But when you start digging in the scientific research and the literature, there's actually almost no scientific evidence that one dog smells better than another.
Yes.
So we thought, why don't we actually look at this? Why don't we test some dogs? And we decided that, why don't we just be easy on ourselves and let's make this an easy test, where, you know, we'll find very clear differences. So we picked the German Shepherd as our good dogs, you know, the
right,
prototypical detection dog. And then we're like, well, what dog can we find that's got to be the worst sniffer out there? And we were actually in Florida at this time, and we happened to have a lot of pugs around. We had some friends with pugs. And we're like, the pugs surely must be the worst,
correct,
sniffer out there. So we picked them. And then there were also lots of greyhounds around, just because we were in Florida. Lots of retired greyhounds happened to be around. And they were a sight hound, so they seemed to be a logical kind of outgroup comparison. So we decided, well, why don't we train these dogs and see who does the best? And basically our goal was really, We're going to demonstrate, you know, what everyone knows, a German Shepherd is better than all the other dogs.
Right. You went in with that sort of presumption that scientists kind of can have as long as they say we're going to try and disprove or see what happens if we try and prove what we all think is true. I mean, isn't that part of being a scientist that you kind of want to put convention on its ear, but you also want to put assumptions to the ultimate test?
Right. So as a scientist, we sort of, we always have our assumptions. We just
yes.
call them hypotheses.
Right,
that's
right.
Basically, that's what our assumption is. And really all we're trying to do in science is actually test our assumptions. Are they true?
Right.
And sometimes we're, you know, we're pretty confident in our assumptions. And I was feeling pretty good about this. It seemed quite logical. But then you go out and you collect the data and you see, well, what does the data say? And you sort of look at it. And when we got the data back, we were looking at it. And I was like, oh, well, you know, we made a mistake here. We mislabeled the group of German Shepherds and called them pugs. And so we looked at it and then it was like, no. And we had pictures, you know, and videotapes of the dogs and the names. And we're like, no, this is correct. And I was just shocked. The pugs were absolutely amazing. They were fantastic when we were training them to do the detection work.
Well,
and
they were sort
so
of what, like eight or something to one or two? I mean, it was dramatically better.
Oh, yeah. So the pugs, the thing that we got with the pugs is that every pug was fantastic. And by the end of I think it was 5 days of training, they were in the like 99% accuracy levels. It was like the 95% confidence interval. They were absolutely outstanding. And when we were comparing the German Shepherds, they were doing well. They were doing about what we would consider average for most dogs. So from lots of experience training a lot of different dogs, they were doing just about sort of the typical average, you know, learning curve that we would expect for most dogs. And the pugs were just doing so much better. So then we thought, well, you know, why don't we dilute the odor? Because that's probably where the German Shepherds are going to show their I guess, their nose muscle, if you will.
Yes.
And so we diluted the odor, and the German Shepherds showed this typical, you know, their performance decreases as the odor gets more and more diluted, which is what we expected. But then the pugs didn't. Their performance after the first dilution was flat. They showed no decrement in performance
so
whatsoever.
So cool.
And then only at the highest dilution did their performance start to drop off. And so then we were sort of like, okay, something is crazy is happening here. So we were trying to think of, well, maybe this isn't related to their nose, right? Because the pugs don't even have a nose.
Right, right.
So this couldn't be related to their nose. So we thought, you know, probably what many pug owners might think is, well, pugs are very greedy. You know,
right.
I've never seen a skinny pug before.
Correct.
And but German Shepherds, right, you know, they can have different, you know, reinforcers. Maybe some are more toy reinforced
right.
versus food. So we thought, well, maybe this isn't to do with their sense of smell, but maybe the pugs are just more food motivated, or maybe they're a little bit smarter just overall. So we thought, well, why don't we train them in the exact same way that we are training with the scent task, but make it something that's not related to their nose, make it something visual. And if it was related to just how sort of greedy or motivated the pugs were, then we would expect that they would perform better again in the same way that they did on the olfactory test. But if this actually had something to do with their nose, then we would anticipate that perhaps that performance on the visual task would be no different. It would show that they're no different in terms of food motivation on the visual task, so that they're learning at the same rate when it comes to something visual, but they only do better when it's something related to their nose. So we came up with a pretty simple game that looks, you know, identical to the scent task, but they had to tell the difference between a tall cup and a short cup.
Really?
And,
that's actually quite
yeah.
an IQ test. I'm impressed. No, really, I wouldn't think that would be something that any dog would necessarily differentiate. So that's a pretty demanding task.
Yeah. So there we thought, well, if the pugs were just going to be, you know, more motivated and greedy than any of the other dogs all the time, then they should learn this task better as well. And so here they're just sort of using their visual stimuli. But if it was related really to their nose, then maybe the dogs would perform the same. And interestingly enough, we found that on this task, when it came to the visual stimulus, both, all the dogs learned them, but the pugs and the German Shepherds learned at exactly the same rate.
So it proved that the pugs really do have better sense of smell.
Yeah, they say, when it came to the olfactory test, they were doing something. And whether it was more that they were paying more attention to their smell world, you know, they're smaller, they're closer to the ground, you know, maybe rooting around for things like food is something that's going to be more familiar to your pugs than your German Shepherds.
Yeah, but you have friends with pugs, and I do too. And Dr. Amy Addis, who's City Pets, is always part of the New York Dog Film Festival in the city. She does nothing but rescue ancient doddering pugs. And they walk on the ground, but they spend a lot of time up on people's laps. You don't sort of think of them
true.
As a dog that's, you know, really out in the wild, really digging the smells. I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
Describe the olfactometer, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. You created a smell box in order to do the test in a highly scientific and regulated way.
Yeah, so we have an olfactometer, which is we use for other studies. We didn't use that one for the pug German Shepherd one, just to clarify. But
okay.
For other studies, especially when we're interested in things like, you know, what kind of odor mixtures can dogs detect, we sort of have, I guess from the dog's perspective, you can call it the fun box. It's basically this box that makes the smells, and it does it by using highly controlled valves and sort of purified air, and it mixes the smells of different jars that have the different sort of odorants in them, and then puts it at a little box that's made out of Teflon so that, you know, sort of the anti-stick stuff so that the odors can't stick to it, so it stays very clean. So then the dogs sort of stick their nose in there, they get the smell, and then the dogs can be trained to either hold their nose in there, press a lever, or make some response to tell us what they smell. And then the box delivers treats to them if they get it correct. So from the dog's perspective, it's like a fun odor box. But from our perspective, it's a really nice tool to allow us to give very, very precise odor stimuli at very specific concentrations and see what can they smell and what can they not smell.
So if you were training, your work is all scientific, but if you were to pass along some of your research and knowledge to those who need a bomb detection dog or an airport dog to detect, you know, contraband being brought in, various kinds of drugs. I guess now the marijuana sniffing dogs are kind of like out of a job. They got to learn to sniff something else if marijuana is going to become legal. Funny things, you know, that we sort of don't think of in the non-dog olfactory world. But do you put in there the very things that you would theoretically, in other words, you're not putting French fries versus pizza versus fried chicken. I'm guessing you're putting in smells that would be smells that would be of value if the dog were to be a working dog, which again, seeing a pug in a working dog outfit is just hard to wrap your head around. But is it smells that are quite distinct and some of them chemical or druggy or something?
Yeah, no, exactly. But going back to the sort of working pug, I can easily imagine, you know, those little soft carriers. You could sort of have a little hole and sort of carry it around with you.
Hold it up to things. Yeah, like
a
handle.
Exactly.
You put a handle on your pug and put the little pug face up to things and see if you get the reaction that you want. But what are the kinds of scents that you purify and disperse in there?
So it depends on the study. For one of the ones that we use the olfactometer for, we were looking at sort of components that are chemicals that are common in homemade explosives. So from a detection perspective, homemade explosives make a very different kind of stimulus than what dogs are typically trained to detect, because a homemade explosive can be made out of a wide variety of different kinds of ingredients.
Right.
And when it comes to that, the dog has to be able to detect almost an unlimited kind of range of mixtures. So the question is how do you sort of tell the dog, you know, this sort of amazingly smart animal that I don't want you to find, you know, one smell. I don't want you to find two smells or 10 smells or 20 smells, but rather I'm interested in you finding thousands of different potential combinations, but to ignore all the other combinations that are safe things like your shampoo or your cake. And so then that creates a very difficult problem for the dogs. And that's what we were using the machine to do, is say, well, if we train them using lots and lots and lots of different examples, sort of in the same way that children learn, you know, what is a tree and what is not a tree and what is a bird and what is not a bird.
Right.
You know, they get lots and lots of different kinds of pictures of these are birds and these are not birds.
Right.
So we did the exact same thing with dogs, and we said, these are dangerous, these are not dangerous. And we sort of saw, well, can they sort of figure it out in the same way that children tend to figure those kinds of things out? And they did. They actually did quite well. And they were able to find out, we were able to give them new pictures, you know, things like they've never seen before, and some complicated ones, you know, like think of giving a young kid who's learning what's a bird and not a bird a picture of a penguin, right?
Right.
So give them these confusing pictures. And they were actually really good at being able to categorize whether it was likely to be safe or dangerous. And it depended on the type of training you gave them. If you just told them, you know, this is what one ingredient I want you to find, then they didn't do as well as if you gave them a wide variety of things. So it was really about the variety of stimuli that tended to improve their performance.
By making it maybe more interesting. I mean, if cocaine only smells a certain way, and you have a dog who just does cocaine sniffing, maybe that becomes dull and boring. Ah, boy, another day at the office, got to sniff for cocaine. Whereas if they had all the ingredients in homemade bombs, plus various kinds of drugs, plus, I don't know, you know, certain kinds of tire rubber that indicated something, it's pretty interesting that the more you challenge them, the more they rose to the occasion. Just, we only have a minute left, Nathan, but I just want to say that you also have done a lot of work with shelter dogs, both improving their lives by including them in your studies, but also not saying that you have to be a purebred dog to be good at any of this. It just helped you in your studies, correct?
Oh, yeah. No, these, you know, shelter dogs, rescue dogs are absolutely amazing dogs to work with because, you know, they're motivated, they want to play, they're super smart, and it gives them something to do and, you know, gets them ready for their home or working careers at the end of it, too. So
it's really nice. It's really a win-win. I think what you're doing is really interesting. Can't wait to hear more about it. Anybody who's thinking of going to school or going back to school, it seems like the Canine Science Collaboratory at Arizona State University or the Canine Lab, Olfaction and otherwise, at Texas Tech U are doing such interesting work, and Nathan Hall has been part of both. And you could go and play with Nathan and the old olfactometer and come up with other cool ideas to find out how cool our dogs are. Nathan, thanks so much for being here and for the very cool stuff you're doing.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you inviting me.
It's a pleasure. Take care. I'll be right back after this quick word. This show is brought to you in part by Iceland Pure Omega-3 Fish Oils for Pets, odor-free human-grade salmon, sardine, and anchovy fish oils from responsibly sourced fish. Freshness and purity are guaranteed with the proprietary aluminum pump bottles and fish from the clean rivers and oceans of Iceland and Norway. This show is also brought to you by Evermore Pet Food, wholly owned by two women, Hannah in Brooklyn and Allison in California, who combine organic vegetables and humanely raised beef, lamb, chicken, and turkey for freshly made, nutritionally balanced pet foods that are low temperature cooked in pouches, then shipped frozen right to your home to be served as a complete meal or as part of your pet's meals. And this show is also brought to you by Zymox Dermatology Products, ear solution, topical cream, and topical spray for skin conditions. All the Zymox skin calming products share a patented LP3 enzyme system, which works to prevent or reduce inflammation and to gently heal skin irritations. Available from your veterinarian or at pet specialty retailers. I am back with Susan Bark, who has a name that actually doesn't fit well because she is a cat rescuer. Susan, welcome to the show. You are from Perfect Pals in Arlington, Washington, that does some incredible things for kittens and their moms and dads. Do people give you a hard time about your name, Susan Bark? Oh my God, your life must
time.
Be so annoying. I'm so sorry.
All the time. No, I love it. I love it. I'm the only cat person in my family, though. Everyone else is a dog person. It makes
sense. So they fit their name maybe a little better than you do, but you know it. What you're doing is so remarkable. Before we talk about your program of bringing cats and kittens into the prison where they're fostered and taken care of by the inmates. Talk a little bit about being the foster and intake manager of Perfect Pals.
So it's a really wonderful job. We get to help so many people, the public and shelters in Washington State, when they need help with litters of kittens or too many adult cats that they can't adopt out. Maybe they have special needs cats that have medical needs that they're not able to pay for care for, like hyperthyroid cats or kitties with asthma, things
right.
like that. Also helping the public. Next week we're going to bring in a cat that may have asthma from an owner that can't care for her. So it's really gratifying.
So,
I really
so
love what
you're
I do.
you're the safety net in a sense for the kitties and of the area.
You know, we definitely help our public shelters, especially Everett Shelter, which is very close to us. You know, they can reach out to us, and we do our best to help. So they definitely all the work that our shelter has done, along with other shelters and rescues over the past several years, has really helped lower the euthanasia rate in Washington State as a whole.
And obviously spay and neuter makes a huge difference. I mean, you don't want to have kitten season. That's just one of the things you don't want in this world, and yet we can't get away from it.
Definitely. You know, there still is a kitten season. I have to say in the past 5 years, we see probably 35-40% less kittens than we did at that time before. So all the spay and neuter that's being done in our state by groups going up and setting clinics in rural areas especially is making a difference to lower the amount of kittens being born.
Which is wonderful because most of those kittens don't have a chance at a decent life. If they're feral and live in a colony that hasn't been TNR'd, then they're going to die. They're going to die from disease or other animals marauding them, or if they aren't too rural, from cars. So you save the unborn lives as well as the ones who are born. Let's talk about this prison program. In the Dog Film Festival, I've had quite a lot of films about dogs from shelters as well as purpose-bred dogs for assistance dogs being raised or trained or rehabilitated, even in with lifetime prisoners. And as they say on both ends of the leash, it does extraordinary things. For the dogs, it's life-saving, and for the prisoners, it gives their life a purpose. Talk about having turned this idea slightly on its head and bringing kittens and I think even grown cats, but particularly kittens, into the Monroe Correctional Complex near you.
Mm-hmm. So how we do this is we set up a partnership back in 2006 to help the inmates have something, a way to give back to society and also socialize. At first, it was a program just for kittens 6 months and under. That were, you know, semi-feral or shy, so they could be socialized and become adoptable. So that's how the program started out. And it's a real collaborative effort. You know, we've got to have staff that's supportive out there, and they are. They support the inmates. And then we go out once a week, myself and my volunteer Karen and Janet, go out there every Tuesday afternoon and spend about an hour with the foster dads and the kitties.
Nice.
Help them and assess the kitties, see what challenges they're having with socialization, different techniques we use to help socialize, like T-touches or clicker training through Jocks and Galaxy we've done recently too.
Nice. So a lot of the things that are used to enrich and improve cats' lives in people's homes, you're also bringing into the prison to enrich that relationship, but also make that cat more adoptable, more socialized. Do you have any of the long-term fosters there, cats who otherwise can't get adopted, or this is mostly kittens so that they'll be more adoptable?
Well, we started taking out adult cats 5 years ago because our shelter is unique. Perfect Pals takes cats back for a lifetime. If someone adopted a cat 10 years ago and can't keep it, they can bring it back. So sometimes cats come back and they're really shy or nervous, and then we can take them out to the foster program. It's called Kitten and Cat Connections at Monroe, and have the guys work with them and help them settle in and make sure that they are used to the new environment and that they're not hiding, that they're eating, and that they're relaxing and interacting with people. So it's really a wonderful thing. Most of the kitties that go there stay there for a month or two, the younger kittens. Sometimes adults have been there up to a year.
Wow.
It's taken us that long to socialize adults that have come from hoarding situations. We do have one cat that lives there pretty much because he doesn't do well here at the shelter, and he's very shy. His name is Rocky Road, and he was a very feral kitten 4 years ago. And now we can handle him, but he definitely doesn't do well anywhere but with his foster dad there.
Isn't that something? So that must be a great sense of empowerment for that gentleman. Is he in for life or just in for a long haul, or what's his particular story?
Yeah, I believe that he is in with a life sentence. Several of the gentlemen are, you know, they are all mentally ill and didn't get proper mental health care and sadly committed some crimes. They're all sexual offenders.
Oh, my. They're all mentally ill? All of the inmates?
Pardon?
All the inmates have been designated as mentally ill?
Yes, yes. In this particular part of the Monroe Correctional Facility, yes, they're all mentally ill. So the nice thing about, you know, the program that we have set up is, you know, they have classes and things they need to do to earn the privilege to foster, including taking their medication and going to group therapy and staying infraction-free. So the kittens and cats really motivated them to stay on the right path and not hopefully get into trouble. So
wow. Isn't that an amazing thing when you think of how many damaged people there are in the world? We're all so focused on cats and dogs and the rough roads they've had in life and, you know, just deficits and how do we overcome them. And here are people living institutionalized because of their deficits, which were not seen, were not dealt with, were not handled for whatever the reasons, ignorance, lack of resources, educational and financial constraints. Isn't it kind of an amazing story that animals that are so low-key as cats can be, particularly ones that are slow to warm up, that these men are all learning how to make life better for the cats. And I imagine it changes them in some way, the men.
It does. You really see them, especially if they're new coming into the program, learning the skills that we teach them and also learning how to be mentored by the other foster dads that are more experienced in the program. And it's really a group effort. So you see them come in and not really maybe know much about cats,
right,
but they like cats. But they learn the techniques. They learn how to properly handle them, how to interact with a feather wand or toys, how to settle them in and help keep them as stress-free as possible, and read their body language. That's a huge part of it, too. And over time, you know, they learn, and every kitty's different. They learn new skills and become more experienced, and it's really gratifying to see the changes. This is an example where the kitties are helping the men, and the men are definitely helping the kitties, so it's a win-win.
It's very touching because particularly with slightly feral or even very feral like Rocky Road cats, it can take a level of patience on the part of a foster or an adoptive person out in the free world, sometimes beyond their capacity to stand it. It's like, I can't wait another 6 months for this cat to let me touch him or play with me. And yet to the men who are incarcerated, all they have is time, Susan. All they have is time. And that's what cats often ask of us.
Yep, and you're so right in that regard. The time is a huge plus for us. They really do, you know, spend 24/7 with them. Each foster dad, they have their own cells. They call them homes. And so they've got plenty of time. Many of the gentlemen in the program work. So the idea is if they're working, the kitty needs to be with another foster dad babysitting. So they're always with somebody, and they definitely have, you know, care, you know, from food, access to food and litter boxes and toys and things like that.
Well, that's definitely more than many cats who live in people's homes. If people have a 12 to 14 hour workday, so many cats have a pretty boring, lonely life, you know, in a perfectly lovely, loving home. But people's reality on the outside is that time is what's at a premium and of which there's too little. So it's quite brilliant that you found a place where all people have is time on their hands. And if they're given something to do that it makes a difference, that changes another life, first the cat and then the people that are able to adopt it later. That's pretty remarkable. When you say they have jobs on the outside or on the inside?
On the inside. Many of the gentlemen in our program work in the kitchen in their unit. So they're preparing food and cleaning up after meals, and they're able to earn a small amount of money to buy things that they would, you know, like to have to make their life a little easier, books and candy and things like that.
And what do you, how do you get the supplies to them, and how do you get the money for that?
So we have the supplies are all provided by the shelter. So what we do is we take out clay litter, and we take out high-end cat food and kitten food.
Wow.
We take out wet food in pouches. We can't have cans out there.
Oh,
and
right.
Litter boxes, scratching posts, cardboard types.
My gosh.
Like that. So we put them in my vehicle and then put them on a cart and haul them quite a ways out to where the unit is. It's usually 200 or 300 pounds, so it's a nice little workout, and take all the supplies into a closet we have out there.
My God, it's really quite an operation you have going, and it's something that requires a weekly check-in. I mean, it's not like you leave the cats there and hope for the best. I mean, it's very hands-on for you guys at Perfect Pals, too.
It is very hands-on, and you know, we go in there, you know, once a week, but they know how to reach us after hours. If there's an emergency, they certainly know that, you know, we're literally a 30, 35-minute drive away if we need to get out there quickly. So they know that we're there to support them, and all the supplies are there. And the gentlemen really work together as a group, helping each other as they care for the kitties during every day. There's, you know, they've got a really set routine, and the kitties, you know, are always taken care of. So we know that they're in good hands.
It's certainly not the harsh and violent depiction of a prison that we see in television series. Far from it. Quite the opposite. All these guys with purring kitties wrapping themselves around their ankles. It's really very touching. You have foster homes in addition to the prisoner foster homes, yes?
Correct, yes.
How many? I mean, like numerically.
We have about 70 right now.
Wow.
We're trying to recruit, and I'm trying to do orientations to get us more. Not everybody is able to foster continuously. Sometimes people foster certain times of the year. You know, people travel, so there's always, you know, people that have, we try to fit it into their schedule and be flexible as we can.
That's fantastic. I was talking just earlier with Sheila Darpino, who is Maddie's fund, and pet foster care homes is one of her passions, and how to promote them and how to underwrite them and how to get more of them. So I don't know if you've had any contact with them, but it's a big important topic at Maddie's Fund, and clearly something you're doing awfully successfully. 70 different people and personalities and locations to manage and nurture and support is really an enormous number, and that's something that a county shelter can't possibly manage. I mean, they're just dealing with the animals on hand hour to hour.
You know, we're really fortunate that most of the public shelters in our area do have their own foster program.
Really?
Which is helpful. You know, they don't normally have probably as many fosters as we have. Being a nonprofit no-kill shelter definitely, you know, helps us recruit fosters. But, you know, when their foster homes get filled up, that's when they're reaching out to us to help with, you know, too many cats and kittens. So they, you know, don't run out of space. It's really important that, you know, we try to work together, and that's really been, I've worked at Perfect Pals for 12 years and seen this collaborative effort really grow, which is really, really wonderful. Shelters helping each other now.
It's fantastic not to be vying for resources in the community, but to join forces so that you're that much stronger and more effective and more efficient. And you reach your goals more successfully. I was very, very pleased to have Perfect Pals be the beneficiary of the Cat Film Festival when it was nearby last year. And one of the things that everyone in the audience got, as I think you might know, but I'm not sure, was a Comfort Zone pheromone diffuser for everyone in the audience to take home. And then the overflow was to go back to Perfect Pals. But what I'd like to do, although we'll come back to your area and bring the film festival again because it's a yearly event, is see if there's a sort of efficient way, efficiency being very important when you have to be in so many places at once, to get pheromone diffusers for those fosters that you have, because if they have a pheromone diffuser going when they bring in a new foster or when it's making that adjustment and transition, it's, you know, scientifically studied that that is one of the most important ways to help a cat feel comfortable in a new place and eliminate the scratching, the outer litter box, and inter-cat problems. So we'll talk about it off the air, but I would love to be able to do that. I think foster families are extraordinary in their generosity. And the more people who try pheromone diffusers and see how they work for cats, they're just so effective on cats, the better it is for all the cats of the world. Fewer relinquishments, fewer cats, even with stress-related medical problems, eventually.
Absolutely. The Philovoy and the pheromone diffusers, we use them here at the shelter. We also use the calming collars and occasionally the sprays.
Nice.
They really do help with new kitties that come in that are nervous and not understanding why they're not at home anymore, or maybe they've been a stray cat from a shelter transfer. It helps calm them down.
That is so great. So you guys don't even need any 411 about it. You're like on board already. I will make sure that you get a bunch of them and that you can distribute them for early Christmas, so to speak, to those foster families, because they deserve all the support.
You.
Not just in making it easier for them with the cat, but in knowing that the outside world really appreciates what they're doing and admires them for their devotion and sacrifice. So thank you so much, Susan Bark, for what you're doing for the Meow Kitties. And I look forward to getting some comfort zone in all those people's hands, because you guys are doing an incredible job there. So keep it up.
Well, thank you so much, Tracy. We really appreciate all your support and airing us on your radio program. And it's very, very exciting to have the support. And thank you so much.
You're so welcome. The unsung heroes of the animal welfare world deserve all the pats on the back and balloons going up in the sky as possible. So I'm happy to do it.